Hello everyone, it's Helen here in Truro, here with my second podcast on paintings by Caravaggio of the Easter story. In my first podcast, I talked about the supper at Emmaus, and in this one, it's the taking of Christ. These two paintings, along with St. John the Baptist in the wilderness, were commissioned by Ciriaco Mattai, the eldest of three brothers of the rich and powerful Mattai family. Just to give you an idea of the extent of their wealth, only the Pope retained more servants than they, and the network of residences of the family and relatives occupied an entire block of the Piazza dei Mattai. At the centre of the block was the massive Mattai Palace, home to Girolamo, the middle son. Though a year younger than Ciriaco, his elevated status as a cardinal earned him the privilege of living in the main family residence. And it was here that Caravaggio stayed for the 2 years from 1601 to 1603 when he carried out the works commissioned by Ciriaco. And it shows just how successful Caravaggio had become following his breakthrough commission in 1599 for the Contarelli Chapel in the church of San Luigi de Francese. Here he is just 2 years later, enjoying the patronage and hospitality of arguably the wealthiest family in Rome. We don't know anything about the background to this commission, beyond concluding that Ciriaco must have been delighted with the supper at Emmaus in order to commission from Caravaggio another work relating to the Passion story. Also, it's reasonable to assume that Girolamo, with his religious background, and Ciriaco, as one of the leading art connoisseurs and collectors of the day, may have suggested ideas which helped shape the picture. And we'll look at some areas where their influence may be felt when we examine the picture in more detail later on. But first, let's start with the story itself. The taking of Christ is the first dramatic and violent episode in the Passion story, the countdown to the crucifixion, when Christ is betrayed by Judas Iscariot after he has been praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. The story is recounted in all four Gospels with variations, and Caravaggio took full advantage of these differences, selecting and excluding details from each gospel in order to produce the most dramatic and emotionally charged version of the story. During his prayer time in the Garden of Gethsemane, Christ has expressed reservations about his mission and even asked his Father for deliverance from the suffering that lies ahead. But he has a vision which gives him strength, and he concludes the prayers, fully resolved to submit to his Father's will. There is now no turning back from the road to the cross. Judas arrives with a large crowd of people armed with swords and clubs, sent by the high priests and elders with the purpose of arresting Christ. Judas has told them that he will identify the man they seek, Jesus, through a kiss of greeting. Once the deed has been done, the soldiers move in to arrest Christ and take him away for trial. The disciples who are with Christ try to prevent him from being arrested, and a fight breaks out. And amidst the chaos and confusion, one of the disciples, named as St. Peter in St. John's Gospel, cuts off the right ear of the slave of the high priest, named Malchus. But Christ rebukes Peter for his violent act and heals the slave's ear. Now, if we take together the Gospels' combined accounts of Christ's response to his arrest by the authorities, they may be summarised as follows. Christ is puzzled by the fact that the men have come armed, as though they are facing a dangerous and violent criminal. He explains that if it was his wish, he could ask his Father for help, and a host of angels would be sent to rescue him. He rebukes the disciples for responding to his arrest with violence, and he observes that the authorities could have arrested him at any time before now when he was preaching daily in the temple. But now is the appointed hour for his arrest, when the powers of darkness are at full strength. So he willingly surrenders to his enemies in order to submit to his Father's will and see the fulfillment of the scriptures. Christ is then taken away for questioning, and the disciples flee the scene. And in St. Mark's Gospel, a young man wearing nothing but a linen coat, usually identified as St. John the Evangelist, in his panic to evade arrest, drops his coat and runs away naked into the night. The taking of Christ has three distinct incidents to it. The betrayal of Christ by Judas, the arrest of Christ by the soldiers, and the flight of the disciples. As we shall see, Caravaggio cleverly combines and condenses these three incidents into his painting in order to produce not only a very powerful and dramatic account of the story, but also to show its significance in the founding and development of the Christian Church. Before we look at Caravaggio's work in detail, I'd first like to compare it with work by another great artist tackling the same subject. That artist is Giotto di Bondone, simply known as Giotto, who is widely renowned as the founder of Renaissance art. His version of The Betrayal of Christ, also known as the Judas Kiss, was one of a series of frescoes he completed for the Scrivani, or Arena Chapel, in Padua in the early 1300s. Now, if you've listened to my podcast on the Supper at Emmaus, you'll recall that I compared Caravaggio's work with that of the same subject by Titian. And my main purpose was to illustrate why Caravaggio's work was seen as being so radically different by his contemporaries. In this case, my motives are somewhat different. I've listened to a number of talks and read articles about Caravaggio's taking of Christ, where invariably comparisons are made with Giotto's earlier masterpiece. And the main purpose of this comparison has been to illustrate the main differences between the two works. Now, while my talk will certainly reveal these differences, what has fascinated me most about this comparison between the two artists is discovering how many similarities they share. I find it intriguing that two artists, separated by 300 years, working largely in a different medium, in the case of Giotto, true fresco, in the case of Caravaggio, oil on canvas, and using a very different style and technique, should nonetheless share such common ground. And for the remaining part of this first section of the podcast, I'd like to explore that in more detail. For a start, both artists were regarded as revolutionaries by their contemporaries. Their style of art was seen as being so radically different, it changed the course of the history of art. We've already considered the main innovations of Caravaggio, namely his dramatic chiaroscuro and his foreshortening, which broke down the boundaries between the picture plane and the viewer's space. Giotto's great innovation was to make a decisive break with the Byzantine tradition, which had dominated art for centuries. This tradition was very flat, stylized, formal, one-dimensional. The human figures were remote and otherworldly, with no attempts at naturalism or realism. The main purpose of art was for decoration and veneration, and the two were inextricably linked, because it was believed that the more beautiful a church, the more mysterious its imagery, the more the art would speak directly to the human soul and encourage prayer and devotion. To a society accustomed to such a tradition in art, Giotto's work came as a revelation. He produced works that were full of life, drama, and emotion. His paintings had a narrative, and his figures were solid, three-dimensional, set in real space, in recognisable settings, whether urban or rural. And one of Giotto's greatest skills was to make his figures, simple though they might appear, so expressive of human emotions, from the strongest, such as anger and joy, to the most subtle, such as jealousy or doubt. And these emotions were rendered with such an intensity of expression that was unprecedented for that time. Both artists were acclaimed by their contemporaries for introducing into their works a new level of realism. We've seen that uncanny realism in Caravaggio's Supper at Emmaus, where the food looks good enough to eat, and we can truly believe we're in the presence of Christ and his disciples. To modernise, the description of Giotto's work as realistic may seem puzzling. His simple block-like figures may seem childish, primitive, naive. His landscapes fairly rudimentary, and his perspective based more on instinct than mathematical principles. But when Giotto's critics spoke of realism, they weren't referring to the photographic-like realism we think of nowadays, of Giotto producing a highly detailed and accurate reproduction of the world he saw. No, what they really admired in Giotto was his amazing ability to extract from nature its essential forms and reproduce these in a very simple yet expressive way. Say he would produce a shape, for example, which was immediately recognisable as being a tree, without the need to show every leaf, twig and branch. But it was in his rendering of the human figure where his realism was most impressive. He reduced the human figure to its most basic forms, but forms which were full of movement, vitality, and expressive of the most subtle and extreme emotions. And the secret behind Giotto's success was this. By producing simple, block-like figures clothed in bold colours, he drew attention to the most expressive parts of the human body, the posture, hands, and faces. A very good example of this is the Lamentation of Christ scene in the Arena Chapel in Padua. The face of the Virgin Mary, made, dare I say it, almost ugly by the grief she's experiencing as she cradles her dead son in her arms, is almost unbearable to watch. And almost as powerful are the hooded figures sitting with their backs towards us. Though we can't see their faces, we can tell by their hunched shoulders and bowed heads that they are in a deep state of mourning. And look at the poignant gesture of the figure on the left, gently supporting the head of Christ in her hands. Then in contrast to this scene of mourning, we have the joyful and tender greeting of Anna and Joachim, the Virgin's parents, at the Golden Gate of Jerusalem. Another of the frescoes in the Arena Chapel at Padua. They are shown embracing after a period of separation, during which God has revealed to them through angels that after many barren years, Anna will soon be with child. So their embrace is strengthened by their joyous news. And the kiss is simply mesmerizing. Joachim places his hand protectively, lovingly on the back of his wife. Anna, as though initiating the kiss, cups his face tenderly in her hands, rifling her fingers through his hair and beard. They stare intently into each other's eyes. Eyes which reveal they've no secrets to hide from each other, only love to share. Their lips lock as though never to be parted. A moment becomes an eternity. Look long enough. After a while, their faces touching become one face, like the lovers in a Picasso painting. I don't think there has ever been, in the history of art, a more loving, tender, touching kiss than that between Anna and Joachim in the Arena Chapel in Padua. So simple, and yet so expressive. Another point of common ground between Giotto and Caravaggio is their sense of theatricality. You can really believe you're at the theatre with the actors playing out the drama on stage. With Caravaggio, his theatrical style is particularly noticeable in his clever use of lighting. He uses it in particular to spotlight the gestures and expressions of the main protagonists in a story. With Giotto, it's more evident in the way that he arranges his characters in a painting, similar to actors on a stage. Take, for example, his Pentecost panel in the National Gallery in London, which dates from 1310 to 1318. It's tiny because it formed much part of a larger altar panel piece, but exquisite. For Christians, the Pentecost is the celebration of the coming of the Holy Spirit to the apostles after the ascension of Christ. And it's told in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 2, verses 1 to 13. Giotto is faithful to the biblical text. He shows the apostles gathered together in a closed room and the Holy Spirit descending upon their heads in the forms of tongues of flame, as well as the traditional symbol of the Spirit, the dove, at the top of the ceiling with rays of light emanating from it. The depiction of the Holy Spirit is fairly straightforward. What is more challenging is to convey the sense of the miracle of the apostles suddenly speaking in different languages, an event which inaugurates the missionary activity of the church. How to convey an audio feature through a visual medium? Giotto's answer lies in clever stage management. Outside the room, in the foreground of the painting, stage front if you like, he presents us with three figures, just three, to represent the multitude who witnessed the miracle and were astonished by it. Just three out of the multitude, so they neither upstage nor obscure the apostles gathered in their room. On the left-hand side is a tall man with a long beard, the longer the beard, the older the person in Giotto's artistic vocabulary, who rests his hand on his chin in a gesture of contemplation. So this elderly wise man is quietly reflecting on the deeper significance of the miracle. His calm, quiet composure contrasts sharply with the agitated state of the two young men also shown in the foreground. Short, clean-shaven, they stand to either side of the doorway of the room, facing each other, looking forward, as if questioning each other as to what on earth is going on. Because we see them in profile, they convey their incredulity, their astonishment to us, and draw us in more closely to the drama. So through these three figures and their arrangement in the foreground, Giotto manages to reveal to us the miraculous nature and deeper significance of the Pentecost, a brilliant piece of stagecraft. Both artists shared a skill which only the greatest artists possess, and that is they had a very clear vision of what they wanted to achieve in their paintings, and the ability to take what they saw with their eye and their inner vision and translate that combined picture onto the surface on which they were working with very few alterations or deviations. I've already discussed in the Supper to Emmaus talk how Caravaggio didn't do any underlying drawings in his paintings. He simply marked out the figures on the primed surface with the back of a paintbrush or a tool. And because he worked with live models paid a daily rate, he had the added incentive to work as quickly as possible. So once he applied paint to canvas, that was it. And yet, despite his rather instinctive way of working, his paintings reflect very few changes, or pentimenti, as they're called. And this is a reflection on his supreme confidence to reproduce perfectly on canvas his inner vision. And his confidence was shared, possibly surpassed, by Giotto. Much of his work was done in the tricky medium of true fresco, that is where paint is applied to wet plaster. I say tricky medium because once the plaster has dried, it's very hard to make changes. The artist would either have to knock out the section of painted plaster and start again, or paint over sections of the dried plaster, which was less durable. Either way, the changes would become more noticeable as the years progressed. In order to minimise errors, therefore, an artist had to have in their mind a very clear vision of the forms they wanted to make in their painting and the sureness of hand to express them as swiftly and accurately as possible. The frescoes in the Arena Chapel Padua reflect very few alterations, displaying that for the most part, Giotto's bold, expressive forms were painted with the unerring facility and precision demanded by that medium. And again, this is a reflection on Giotto's supreme self-confidence in his innate artistic ability. And one of the most popular stories related of him, among others by Vasari in his Lives of the Great Artists, provides evidence of this self-confidence. Vasari relates how Pope Benedict IX was seeking artists to do work for him on the Basilica of St. Peter's in Rome. He'd heard of Giotto's great reputation as an artist and sought proof to back up the claims. So he sent a courtier to Giotto to ask for samples of his work. In response to this request, Giotto took a large sheet of paper, a paintbrush loaded with paint, and with one twist of his hand, produced a single shape. He then handed the sheet to the courtier to take back to the Pope as the requested sample. Well, the courtier, who'd expected Giotto to produce a full set of drawings, was hugely embarrassed by this meagre sample, but too timid to challenge Giotto. So he sadly returned to the Pope, fully expecting to be reprimanded for his failed mission. Well, if the courtier was surprised by Giotto's actions, he was even more astonished by the Pope's response to them. Far from being disappointed, the Pope was delighted and needed no further evidence of Giotto's skills. Because any artist who, without the aid of a compass and with the single twist of his hand, produced, as Giotto had done, the perfect circle, had to be a superb artist. Above all, both Giotto and Caravaggio shared two common objectives in approaching their religious works. One was to tell the Bible stories in a way that was clear and direct, and in a way that was understandable, believable, and relevant to ordinary people. They both, I believe, were influenced by the spiritual discipline known as visualization. First developed by Francis of Assisi and his followers, and later made popular by the founder of the Jesuit order, Ignatius Loyola, in his spiritual exercises. And the Archbishop of Milan, when Caravaggio was growing up, Carlo Borromeo, was a huge fan of this discipline. Caravaggio would probably have been most influenced by Borromeo's ideas, whereas Giotto would have had direct contact with the followers of St. Francis. Indeed, when Giotto was working on the scenes in the life of St. Francis in the Assisi Chapel, where the saint is buried, he so immersed himself in the spiritual ideas of the order that he became a lay member. Visualization was a spiritual discipline which encouraged the believer to visualize scenes from the Bible in order to deepen their faith and spirituality. Having visualized the scene, they would then imagine themselves there and seek to empathize with the feelings and emotions of the people in the story. Stories about Christ, particularly his passion, were especially popular for this visualization process, because it was believed that the more you could understand how much Christ had suffered as a human, both emotionally and physically for your sake, the more your love for him would grow and your faith deepen. And I believe that both Giotto and Caravaggio saw their art as being a visual aid to this spiritual discipline. Instead of having to create the pictures in their own mind from scratch, the believer could meditate upon the work of either of these artists. Caravaggio's approach was to update the Bible stories to his own time and place, and to make the paintings look so realistic and the events so immediate, so in the moment, that the viewer not only believes themselves to be there, but feels they are participating in the action. He does all the hard work for the viewer, a bit like those revision exam papers where the model answers are supplied at the back. In the case of Giotto, rather than providing photographic-like realism in his paintings, he provides lots of detailed information, particularly of a practical nature, in order to assist the viewer in creating an accurate picture in their mind of the story. Take, for example, the fresco in the Arena Chapel showing the triumphant entry of Christ into Jerusalem, as told in St. Mark's Gospel, chapter 11. In verses 7 and 8, we're told that the disciples piled cloaks on the back of the donkey to serve as a saddle for Christ, and that people in the crowds welcome Christ by lining the roads with their clothing and with branches cut from the fields. There's a lot packed into those two verses, and Giotto gives us all the details and considerably more. For example, he shows people in the crowd in different stages of removing items of their clothing to line the processional route. So one man is shown having already managed to get one arm out of the sleeve of his top. A second man is shown pulling the top over his head. And a third man, having removed his top, is laying it on the ground as Christ approaches on the donkey. In the background, he shows people actually climbing trees to cut down branches. And we can also see the pile of cloaks that the disciples placed on the donkey's back to give Christ a more comfortable journey. So Giotto packs in an incredible amount of detail to not only support the gospel text, but enlarge on it, giving the believer much help in their visualization process. As well, of course, much interest and delight to any viewer of the painting. And then the second objective of the two artists, which follows on from the first and is very much connected to it, in their religious works, both artists focus on bringing out the full drama and emotional core of the story. And in doing so, they seek to underline its deeper spiritual significance. In the betrayal or taking of Christ, both Giotto and Caravaggio agree that the central theme of this story is the betrayal of Christ, an innocent man, by one of his closest friends. And so they make the interaction between Christ and Judas the main focus of their painting. And because they focus on this confrontation between two friends, they both appeal to our humanity, make us wonder what it must have been like for Christ to have been betrayed by a man he thought was loyal and loving, and abandoned by all his closest friends at his hour of greatest need. But they ask awkward questions too. By so involving us in this act of betrayal, they implicate us in it as well. We're not just passive spectators, we're active accusers, associated by virtue of our sinful condition with Judas and Christ's opponents. So there's no room for complacency. We're challenged and provoked. And it's because the artists had a shared vision and common objectives in approaching their religious works that while their style and technique may be very different, the impact their paintings have on the viewer can be very similar. You're left feeling emotionally drained, uplifted, inspired, exhilarated, challenged. All these emotions and more. And above all, an image in your mind's eye of the painting, which is simply unforgettable. That's why I can no longer read an account of the betrayal and arrest of Christ without bringing to mind those powerful images of Christ and Judas, presented in the respective paintings by Giotto and Caravaggio. And these two magnificent paintings will be the focus of our attention for the remaining four parts of the podcast. In parts 2 and 3, we'll look at Giotto's painting, The Betrayal of Christ, also known as the Judas Kiss, which is in the Scrivani or Arena Chapel in Padua. And then in parts 4 and 5, we'll look at Caravaggio's work, The Taking of Christ, which is in the National Gallery of Ireland in Dublin. And in those two parts, I'll not only be giving a commentary on the painting, but telling the fascinating story of how it was rediscovered after many years thought lost to the world. A story almost as fascinating as the painting itself. So I hope very much to enjoy your company for those forthcoming parts of the podcast. In the meantime, do check out the London Walks website for the entire range of tours available, including both the regular walks and the virtual tours. Enjoy the summer, stay safe, and take care. Goodbye.